Next case this half for this afternoon is case number 67228, Jeremias versus State. The court welcomes Ms. Thomas and Mr. Stanton. Thank you for being here today from Clark County. And Ms. Thomas, we're ready for you to go. This is a 60-minute argument, 30 minutes each side.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice Terry, Justices. I'm General Thomas, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Ralph Jeremias. I'm hoping to reserve 8 minutes for rebuttal. This appeal presents a number of issues. I certainly stand by all of them. This afternoon, I intend to focus on the three issues identified by the court in its synopsis, those being the public trial violation, cross-examination of the state's primary witness, and the Lord v. State issue. I'm also hoping to address the introduction of a videotape during deliberations, the issue of concerning life without the possibility of parole in the Geary case, and I hope the lay witness testimony concerning pieces of plastic. As to the first issue, in this case, the Jeremias family wished to watch jury selection. They were present in the courtroom. The prosecutor informed the judge that they were there, stated he had objections to them being there, but he had talked with defense counsel and they understood that the family would have to leave. The judge then stated that every seat in the courtroom would be needed and they would have to go at least until some people were excused. Jury selection in this case took approximately 2 days. There's no sign that the family came back during the first day. While defense counsel certainly shouldn't have objected at this point that it was a violation of Mr. Jeremias' public trial right, it's clear that under Presley v. Georgia, a 2010 U.S. Supreme Court decision, that this was plain error to exclude the family. There's a constitutional right for the public to be present during jury selection, and that right was violated in this case. It's unfortunate that that case was not brought to the attention of the district court by either the state, the defense attorney, or by the court itself. But the fact remains that in this very important case, the public, including Mr. Jeremias' family, was excluded from the courtroom. And we know from the Presley v. Georgia case that courtroom congestion alone cannot justify closure of a courtroom during jury selection. I would urge the court in this case to reverse on those grounds.
What about Weaver?
Weaver came out in 2017. I've noticed it as supplemental authority. Weaver is very distinguishable in that that was a habeas corpus case, where the issue was the Strickland standard, which requires a showing of prejudice. This case falls between Presley and Weaver. In Presley, there was a proper objection. Here, there was not. In Weaver, it was a habeas corpus proceeding, long down the road from the proceedings itself.
From the Weaver either.
That's correct. And in Weaver, the Supreme Court talks about why there are different standards for a direct appeal and for a habeas proceeding. It focuses on first the objection and the ability of the trial court to correct the error, but then also goes on to explain that on direct appeal, the courts have a supervisory authority over the district courts. And there's also less interest in finality than there is in habeas proceedings. And there's also, it's sooner, so there's a more temporal reason for reversing on direct appeal as opposed to habeas. So I don't think Weaver forecloses in any way this issue, and in fact, emphasizes why it should be brought up on direct appeal. I would urge this court to follow the Seventh Circuit approach in requiring a waiver on the record. Not just assuming a waiver based upon the failure to object. And the reason for that is this. There are certain constitutional rights that are clearly spelled out in the Constitution. The right to counsel, the right to a jury trial, the right to a speedy trial, the right to a public trial. In no other context do we assume waiver simply because an objection isn't made. In fact, every guilty plea has an affirmative waiver of each of these rights, and I can see no reason why you would require that waiver for a guilty plea, but not for a trial. If a bench trial is had, the client is canvassed. The client is given an admonishment regarding their right to testify. If counsel is to be forfeited, there's a Feretta canvass. This right, spelled out in the Constitution, just like all those other rights, should be given the same dignity and respect, and there should be an affirmative waiver on the record.
Counsel, I'm sorry to interrupt you. What's counsel's incentive to make the objection?
If they can just
wait and see how it works out and raise it on direct appeal. The court addressed that concern just a bit there in Turrieta 696 F3rd 972 about the gamesmanship, that preserving the issue by objection has value in that. What would be counsel's incentive if I look, they threw my family out? I'm going to be quiet. We'll see how this comes out. If I win, great. If I don't, I'm going to get a do-over.
I agree that's a problem, but that's also why we have three different actors in the courtroom: a district attorney, a judge, a defense attorney. At the point that the prosecutor is moving for the removal of the family, this is not a case where the record is quiet about was the courtroom open or not. The prosecutor objected to the family being there. And under Presley, four criteria were required for that closure to happen. The judge is in the courtroom. And just like we wouldn't assume that a bench trial was valid in the absence of an objection, we should not be assuming that the denial of a public trial right is okay. And again, that goes to that tier one spelled out in the Constitution rights, that those big ticket items, there needs to be an affirmative waiver following admonishment.
Isn't that Seventh Circuit case something of an outlier?
Your Honor, I believe that case has been, at least the courts recognize that plain error can apply. In three other federal courts, I believe it's six other state courts, plus the District of Columbia. I acknowledge it, and it's spelled out in the reply brief, that there is a split of authority on this issue. I'm urging this court, as a matter of state constitutional law, as well as the federal constitution, to have the bright line rule, to say for this clear constitutional violation, we need a waiver on the record. I can't imagine why we would require it for every other constitutional violation but the public trial right.
Well, the public trial right is part of the public's right as well as the defendant's right, correct?
Right.
So that's a little different than the affirmative waiver concept. You're really putting forward the position that this right cannot be forfeited. Is that?
Yes, without and knowing an intelligent waiver, it should not be forfeited.
Well, there are different concepts, waiver and forfeiture, right?
Exactly. And waiver of a constitutional right, just like Feretta, just like a bench conference, just like the right to testify, should be based on a clear admonishment to the client stating, here are your rights, do you want to waive them? Just like we do for a guilty plea in every single case. This isn't asking that much, that on those primary constitutional rights, that there be an affirmative waiver on the record.
Counsel, the court under Presley, the court can, even over the defendant's objection, so they don't have to consent to it, they can object, and there are circumstances under which the court can exclude some people from that portion of the voir dire. So it's not just up to the defendant to waive.
That's correct, Your Honor. There are some very limited circumstances. It's a difficult burden to meet. It was nowhere near met in this case. I do agree there are some limited circumstances where the public trial right can be.
What was the judge's findings to exclude?
There were none other than courtroom congestion.
That was the only finding?
Right, that every seat in the courtroom would be taken up by the jury panel. And we know from Presley that that's not a valid reason.
Counsel, if we adopt the rule that you're suggesting, what competent counsel, defense counsel, would object if they saw a public trial right violation?
I think everyone should. But that burden also falls on the district attorney. It falls on the trial court, especially in a death penalty case, where when you're looking at a manifest injustice standard under plain error, even if you don't go for the waiver standard, if you look at manifest injustice, it's said over and over again, death is different. But jury selection on a death penalty case truly is different, where you know that this jury will be making a subjective determination of whether to impose mercy. Things like demeanor and body language, tone of voice, who's glaring at the defendant while counsel's at the bench with the district court. Those factors matter. And it's not like we can look at a JAVS video and make those determinations outside of the record. Juries aren't filmed on the court recording system. So there's no way to make that assessment. But where a jury is making the most critical of subjective decisions, having the public present, having the client's family present if they want to be, is of critical importance, and it is different than every other case. If I may, I'd like to go on to the next issue concerning examination of Carlos Zapata. In this case, the prosecutor's examination began by asking the state's primary witness, the co-defendant, not what he remembered about the case, but what he remembered telling the detectives about the case. There was an objection, a conference at the bench, then the examination continued on some background information. But when it gets to the heart of the case, what happened inside that apartment, that all changes again. And the prosecutor is asking the witness, you remember verbatim what you told the detectives 5 years prior, without any proper foundation, without asking, do you remember what Mr. Jeremiah said about what happened inside the apartment? And without that lack of a critical foundation, that the witness doesn't have a memory, that he needs to have his memory refreshed, it was entirely improper to then go to that transcript and to use it as a script. And I urge you to look at that examination itself. It couldn't all be spelled out in the briefs. There simply wasn't enough time. It goes on for page after page after page of the interrogation being used as a script to lead this witness through exactly what the prosecutor wants him to say. And this is not an issue. I can't recall ever raising this issue before. Normally, these evidentiary issues don't have quite as much significance on the form of the question. But in this case, where it's the state's primary witness talking about the heart of the case, the rules of evidence do become critical.
I'm sorry. When the attorney objected, the court sustained the objection.
Initially.
The court sustained the objection.
Right.
And then the prosecutor asked arguably a series of continuing improper questions that were asked without objection. And then finally the defense attorney objected again. And that was off the record conference.
Objected at least 4 or 5 times. And at the very critical portion of the transcript, where he's talking about what happened inside the apartment, there was an objection and it was overruled. And then the witness doesn't start talking about his memory of events. He reads the transcript of his interrogation out loud. Entirely improper. And going back to the Shoup case that explains why, I urge this court to find that's not a proper technique. It's not permissible. And here, the state didn't even argue a lack of prejudice. They said that it was a proper methodology, and it wasn't. The next issue I'd like to address is Lord v. State.
Could I ask you a question on the issue you just addressed?
Certainly.
Assuming that the court was inclined to agree with your assignment of error with respect to this process or method of engaging Zapata as a witness and securing his testimony, there do appear to be, or at least it's argued, that there are 4 critical areas of his testimony that were not prompted or scripted. I wanted to get your take on that.
I agree. Some of the issues.
He inculpated Jeremias in the murders. That was unprompted. He testified that Jeremias planned the robbery. Unprompted. brought a gun, went into the victim's apartment, and came running out in a panic after gunshots, unprompted. Would you agree with that?
I do.
Okay. So in assessing this error, as we do in other evidentiary errors, we look at it for harmless error. Would seem like the unprompted responses would still support the verdict.
They probably support a verdict for felony murder. They do not support a verdict of premeditation and deliberation. That crux of the testimony that establishes premeditation and deliberation comes from the script. And that becomes critical in a case where felony murder is an aggravator. And crucial in establishing that that aggravator should apply. Here there was a special verdict. The jury found both premeditation and felony murder. I do agree that that evidence is strongest on the premeditation issue. Your Honor, I would also note that's not an argument the state made. In its answering brief, there's no discussion of prejudice. Mm-hmm. And under Polk, I would submit that they forfeited that issue.
Okay, thank you.
As to the transcript from the Lord v. State issue, in this case, the state presented Ivan Rios's interrogation transcript through a detective. Mr. Rios did not testify, and in fact had never been cross-examined in any proceeding about that transcript. In Lord v. State, this court held that that type of testimony violated Bruton, and there were two foundations for that. There was both the Sixth Amendment violation, but also the Fifth Amendment due process recognition that that type of testimony is inherently unreliable. That a co-defendant being interrogated by detectives has every incentive to minimize his own conduct and to place blame on someone else. In Summers v. State, this court distinguished Lord under the Bruton grounds and held the confrontation clause does not apply, Crawford rights do not apply in the penalty phase of a capital case. It didn't overrule Lord, it said it's confined to its facts. The facts of Lord are the facts of this case. They are exactly the facts of this case. A non-testifying co-defendant gave a statement to a detective that implicated the defendant. It was highly damaging. It was relied on extensively by the prosecutor during the closing argument. The state argues in its answering brief that Thomas versus State overruled Lord v. State. Thomas doesn't mention Lord once. There's no rule that recognizes that a case can be overruled in that manner, and especially given that Summers and Thomas were issued on the same day. Summers did talk about Lord, and it distinguished Lord. It didn't overrule Lord. There's no reason to believe that Lord was overruled, and it shouldn't be. Aside from the Bruton issues, just the inherent unreliability that's been recognized by the U.S. Supreme Court, I believe one of the cases is Lee versus Illinois, that says this court has time and time again recognized the co-defendant's statements during an interrogation, not subject to being sworn under oath, not having to address presiding over the proceedings, not subject to cross-examination, is inherently unreliable. The second aspect of that is the lack of notice. This issue was not raised in the state's notice of evidence in aggravation. It gave no notice that they intended to present this testimony. Had they done so, trial counsel could have done some research and found the Lord case and argued that it was not admissible. Allowing that evidence in without notice is the second reason why it should have been excluded. There are a lot of other issues in this case. I'd briefly like to talk about the interrogation of Mr. Jeremias that was admitted as evidence at the close of the case, but never played for the jury prior to closings. The jury's first view of that evidence was in the deliberation room. It's simply not how it's done. Evidence is presented during trial, where the parties have a chance to view it. The public has a chance to view it. The counsel can observe the demeanor of the jury as they're watching that evidence and tailor their closing arguments to fit that evidence. To allow evidence, especially of this critical nature, to be presented for the first time during deliberations is highly improper and certainly shouldn't be allowed. The next issue, and probably the last one I can really hit, is the Geary v. State cross-examination that happens during the cross-examination of Tammy Bass. Ms. Bass was a former parole board member. She was called by the defense to discuss parole board procedures. On cross-examination, the prosecutor begins by saying, "Ms. Bass, are you familiar with the Geary case?" She says, "No." I think that should have been the end of it. But instead, through that cross-examination, he informs his jury that Mr. Geary had a sentence of life without the possibility of parole. It was commuted by the Pardons Board. He was let out on parole, and he killed another person.
I'm very familiar with it. I was his lawyer.
I imagine Mr. Stanton was familiar with it because he was in Washoe County. I was a staff attorney at the court. There's no reason to believe the two defense attorneys had any knowledge of this case. And certainly, again, they should have objected, and they certainly should have been examining Ms. Bass about the fact that in 1995, the law changed. Commutations are no longer allowed. What happened to Mr. Geary could never happen to Mr. Jeremias had he been sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. But the fact is that this jury was informed through that cross-examination that life without does not really mean life without, that it can be commuted by the Pardons Board and he can be let free. And what can be more damaging than that in a death penalty case? Under this court's mandatory review, under NRS 177055, I urge you to find that this was highly improper and to reverse on that basis.
You have your 8 minutes left.
Thank you.
Mr. Stanton for the state of Nevada.
If I could, go in reverse order from counsel's arguments. First of all, the comments and the colloquy between myself and Ms. Bass was not to elicit the fact of life without parole doesn't mean life without parole. In fact, this jury was properly instructed in that regard. It was never argued by the state. It was never an issue in this case as presented to this jury. Ms. Bass is commonly noticed by defense experts in murder cases and in capital cases to talk about the parole process. And while her testimony varies depending upon certain facts of the case, in this particular case, as you look at Ms. Bass' testimony on direct examination in toto, was clearly that the parole board is a highly selected process to get on it, and that the vetting process to grant parole is very restrictive, and that very few people under certain circumstances, these types of cases, and this case in particular, would be a reasonable candidate for parole. And thus, the Geary case is, I think, a direct and relevant question to inquire of a former or current member of the parole board about that vetting process as it changes over time, based upon the governor, who the governor is, who they select, how experienced those individuals are, the population of the Nevada Department of Corrections, all of which play a critical role and changes as far as the release valve, if you will, of parole over time.
Why would you go into a specific case like Geary? Here's a guy who, Bill Maupin and I represented him. He got convicted, got life without in Clark County. Then later he was, his life without was commuted to life with. He got paroled, he went to Sparks, was in an AA meeting, met some guy, killed the guy, got the death penalty, and then died of cancer before he was executed. I mean, why would you go to a specific case like Geary? There are a lot of cases where situations about parole is relevant, but why is it relevant in this case?
Because of how the parole board's role in releasing Geary and Geary 2 prior to Geary 2.0 and the timing of when that decision was made mirrored when Ms. Bass was on the parole board. She claimed that she didn't recall it. I don't know that I have the records for sure now. I did research immediately after the trial as to whether she was a sitting member of the parole board, but that precise reason and the documented history of Geary transitioning from 1.0 to 2.0, I think is a good example, both pros and cons for the parole process. And so that's why I chose no here.
Sir, don't you think you can break that into two parts, really. Yeah, the first part is responding to these people just don't get out on parole. And like, okay, here's an example of somebody who was convicted of murder who got out on parole. Fair. To add, and then he went out and stabbed and killed somebody. It's that addition that seems a little problematic.
Well, I don't know how that addition is problematic because it's factually accurate. The claim here on appeal is that the question by advising Ms. Bass of the underlying facts of Geary was that life without parole doesn't mean life without parole. I mean, there is no objection, nor could I grasp how one could object to the underlying facts, because Mel Geary's murders were very uniquely the same.
But if he got life with, it would be relevant. But he got life without, it wasn't relevant, because life without is not, you're not able to have it commuted anymore. So it's not relevant to Jeremiah.
Well, it's not relevant in that component of it, but it was strictly used as a device to Ms. Bass because she didn't remember the Geary case. And thus, to me, the Geary case is one of some note procedurally how it occurred, and thus that was the question designed to for her to recognize, if she could, the Geary case. Once again, it was never argued, and the jury was properly instructed about what life without possibility of parole means.
But isn't the second part of that, the inference that you're asking the jurors to draw, is that not only could he get out, but if he does, he's going to kill again? I mean, it's the second part that I have a question about, the relevance of that in this context.
Well, I think that's a relevant argument if the argument is positioned to the jury of whether or not to grant parole. And I think that there's, if those facts were elicited at a penalty hearing, then certainly the prediction of future violence is unpredictable, and thus a case like that, assuming Ms. Bass would opine contrary to that, would be relevant inquiry. But we weren't at argument of life without parole or parole. That's not what the defense suggested. That's not what the defense argued. And that's not the purpose of Ms. Bass, at least in the context of her primary direct question. And that was simply to reiterate that the parole process is at times flawed. And so that was the purpose of that question. And in the counsel's comments about the statements that were made by Mr. Rios that were introduced at the penalty phase, let me first go back and put into context the underlying facts and the precise nature of the testimony. At the penalty hearing, the defense or the state elicited through Detective Dan Long, the primary homicide detective, evidence of a portion of Mr. Rios's statement to the detectives. Once again, his statement was not played. It was not admitted. There were two areas that the state specifically inquired through the Q&A process and designed strictly to admit certain targeted areas of information. What had happened was, is Mr. Rios and Mr. Jeremias were roommates, and they were arrested together at the same time compared to Mr. Zapata, who was at another location and arrested at a separate and distinct time. The overwhelming nature of this case is Mr. Jeremias was the shot caller. He was the alpha dog of this three-man crew that did what they did and other things. And Mr. Rios was, as was presented in his trial, someone who had recently suffered medical ailments and was slow learning. At the time of his arrest, Detective Long asked him, this is recorded surreptitiously by the detective, asked Mr. Rios if he wants to speak to them about what occurred. And Mr. Rios doesn't say anything in response, but sometime later walks up and whispers to Detective Long, I want to talk to you, but I'm afraid he, Mr. Jeremias, would kill me if he sees me doing this. So at the scene, they didn't separate him and put him into two different vehicles and conduct an interview. They structured their approach to this differently so that that concern was alleviated for Mr. Rios. So that was specifically elicited. The second thing is Mr. Rios doesn't, as counsel suggests, that it's a violation of Bruton. He did not turn around and give a statement that exculpated himself and inculpated Mr. Zapata and Mr. Jeremias, quite the contrary. He gave the detectives the ammunition that ultimately led to his arrest because his presence at this scene was not known. There was no witness to it. And there are two visits to the victim's home. There's one where Mr. Jeremias goes up with a plan to initiate the robbery, somehow incapacitate the individuals, get the other people to come up, and then assist because there was a large amount of material to take out. This is broad daylight in an apartment complex. What the evidence suggests, both from partially from the co-defendants, that is Mr. Zapata and Mr. Rios, was that all of a sudden gunshots are heard and Mr. Jeremias comes running down to the car and says, take off. There was no property taken. And the evidence, uncontroverted, suggests that Mr. Jeremias insists, after exposing themselves to that kind of potential observation by third parties, demands that they go back because otherwise all this is for nothing. And so in the statement that Mr. Rios gives, he describes precisely his role, but it's uncontroverted that Rios never came back to the home the second time. Mr. Rios was tried under those set of facts, and he was acquitted. And so the concerns of Bruton, beyond the framework of whether or not this is a Bruton violation, which I submit respectfully is not, and number two, whether the confrontation clause is embraced in this scenario, which once again, I respectfully submit it is not. It was limited solely to those two different issues, to explain that the process of how the plan to rob these two young men occurred, and also to describe his observations via that statement of his co-defendant and roommate, Mr. Jeremias. The courtroom issue. Number one, there was comments about it being the public being excluded. No such thing happened. The court did not rule that. And Justice Cherry, you inquired of appellate counsel about what was the finding of the court. The finding of the court was that there were no seats in the courtroom to have the panel that was brought up. And as I look at the faces of this court, I know several of you have been, as a district court judge, presiding over either a high-profile, either murder case or a capital case. And there is a logistical process that's involved here because the court knows precisely to the seat how many seats are in their courtroom. And when they order up a panel such as this, knowing that you're going to get a chunk of people excused pretty quickly, that they call down to the jury commissioners, and I'm just going to pull out round numbers here, and say, look, we need 75 jurors because that's what my courtroom will hold. So the bailiff lines them out in the courtroom, numbers juror number 1 through 75, not actually sequentially that way, but they're in order. And then they come in and sit in the box, in the prospective alternate boxes, and then in the courtroom by order and in fashion. So both the court and counsel, when they exercise preempts or look back at the jury, they know what seat they're in. So if this, and I'm not belittling the issue of the right of public trial, that right is well known to this body. The problem with it is where do you draw the line about who can come in, what notice is given to the court that you're going to have someone from his family? Is that 2 members, 5 members, 10 members? And what's the logistical demands of a district court when they then become a capital jury selection process? And being fair to counsel, as well as their staff, to be able to recognize the numbers of the people that are speaking and in what order they are in the courtroom. If this is an issue, and I would suggest it's not, because the court never ordered the courtroom closed. In fact, Judge Adair specifically stated in her ruling that there's going to be empty seats in here in very short order. There was never an order to exclude anybody in this case. And so I would just think that's a very important fact in addressing whether or not a constitutional violation occurred. The next is the examination of Carlos Zapata.
Just before we leave that area.
Sure.
So if there weren't enough seats, and so there's going to be some empty in a few, were the other members of the public who happen to be families in this instance, would they have been permitted to stand in the back?
Well, in my experience, that question would be up to the bailiff or the marshal controlling the security of the courtroom. The concern would be if there's members of the family, either from the defendant or from the alleged victim at that juncture, the security concerns of them standing up in the confines of small courtrooms, relatively speaking, for security reasons, to be able to do something or to approach somebody, I think would be a very difficult situation from a security perspective. I don't know, but I would doubt that they would be allowed to stand during the process. Normally what happens in congested courtrooms in the 8th Judicial District Court every day is members of the public who have cases down there and family are told to wait out into the hallway until they see people leave, and there's a vestibule area where they can look through the windows and then just see if there's an empty seat. And so that's how and why I think this is not a violation of that constitutional principle.
But don't you agree that logistics alone would not be a sufficient reason for a judge to exclude members of the public?
Alone it is not. And in those cases where they exclude them for a protracted period of time. And remember, I think the record is quite clear. The court never ordered that the public be excluded. All what the court said is, we will have a potential denier here filling every seat, and they're welcome to come back when the seats are empty.
Come back, imply, get out until there's an empty seat? I mean, you're saying they didn't order them to leave, but isn't that the necessary negative implication?
I guess maybe it is, but then the question becomes, is it first come, first serve? Is it something that the importance of the venire, you fill that up until public seating is available? I don't know how they did it in the O.J. Simpson case, but my guess is that there's some sort of solution, but without some prior knowledge, logistically, the court has the potential denier sitting in every single seat. And it's not that long before, especially in a case like this, when there's a multitude of empty seats.
Do you believe that the defense attorney consented to have the family out? I mean, it's unclear to me. The prosecutor stood up, made an objection.
I think that addresses what to me is a secondary logistical issue of concern of trial counsel. Trial counsel from the state and the defense in a case like this, what are they? They can just see, like I could, that if members of the family, once again, victim's family, defendant's family, both, that during a congested, crowded courtroom, when the case begins, is nothing but potential problems. People saying something. There's no instruction given to family members at this juncture about when they should or shouldn't talk about the case in the hallway during recesses. Everybody's mingling out there together. And so the potential of communications being overheard or things being said that would infect the process in toto is severe. And I think defense counsel, the court, and certainly the state recognized it and felt that that was the most appropriate method to handle it.
So how was the issue handled with the intern?
I don't recall, Judge.
For whom was provided?
I think the intern for the Special Public Defender's Office was granted the front row seat behind counsel's table. The examination of Carlos Zapata, and counsel says that she's never seen an examination like this. Well, let me put once again into context how Mr. Zapata's testimony appeared and arrived on this case in front of Judge Adair. Once again, Judge Adair had already heard the trial of State versus Ivan Rios, where Carlos Zapata, pursuant to his agreement with the state, was called to testify and testified in that case. Carlos Zapata is a co-defendant. He's not a lay witness. And that is a substantial difference, I would submit. In conjunction with that, his sophistication about knowing about areas to stay away from were limited. The references of gang monikers, the references of multitude of inadmissible, highly flammable facts that he knew about them, that is this three-person crew of Jeremiah, Zapata, and Rios, as well as what was occurring immediately prior to these murders and robbery, and after, all replete with inadmissible, highly inflammatory substance. And Judge Adair knew, and the Special Public Defender Trial Counsel knew, because they sat in during the Rios trial. This is solely the product of the judge and defense counsel being cautious that something was not said that shouldn't be said. And Justice Hardesty, you mentioned the four areas of inquiry that were more of the open-ended direct examination that you may be used to. Those were the areas where the state was comfortable that we could go with some sort of a leash. But when we talked about going, and counsel says when they're back up in the home, that's the critical area. Actually, that's not the critical area at all. The murders had already occurred, and the evidence was overwhelming outside of Mr. Zapata's statement that this was a robbery because all of the victims' belongings were found in all three defendants' residences. Their computers, prepackaged marijuana, the ATM debit cards of both victims. All three defendants were caught within hours on surveillance video at various gas stations and casinos in the valley using the victims' credit cards. So there's nothing critical at all about the testimony of what occurred in the apartment. And thus, I would submit this is an this examination was done not only foundationally correct, that he could not, because my question was quite precise to Mr. Zapata, and counsel belittles it and saying, look, you can't remember each word verbatim as you gave either in the interview and prior testimony. Well, foundationally, that's the correct question to ask, but more importantly, there was a short leash of what Mr. Zapata needed to address before he got off the rails into an area that no one in that courtroom wanted it to go to. And thus, I think that contextually is critical in understanding that testimony.
Mr. Stanton, on the point that I was discussing with Ms. Thomas, she argues that the recognition of this error would have affected premeditation. What's your assessment of that point?
Yeah, I think the premeditation is established before any of this question occurs. The premeditation is established by the nature of the killings themselves, how they were killed, the manner in which they were killed, and the connection that Mr. Jeremias had with these two individuals. The premeditation is, and related to the issue of the plastic bags, that one victim is sitting upright, or fairly upright in a couch, with his keyboard right in front of him with an execution gunshot wound to his head. Clearly no idea that anything was going to occur to him. The second victim, Mr. Stevens, is on his knees, bent over into a couch, with his head down, with his phone underneath him, with a pillow on top and the execution gunshot wound through the head. So the scene itself, just as hard to see, is what establishes premeditation and deliberation in itself, as opposed to the circumstances of what occurred when the return to the apartment to facilitate the rest of the theft occurred. So I think it's the felony murder rule is established, once again, not only by that testimony, but more importantly and more convincingly by the physical evidence, and that is the proceeds of victims as found in each of the defendant's personal property at the home during search warrants. Unless the court had any further questions, I appreciate your time.
Before you go, address the applicability of Weaver to our facts on the jury selection.
Well, in the context of the...
Well, Weaver was not preserved. This one was not preserved. But Weaver was on habeas, and this one's at direct appeal. Is that a distinction without a difference for you, or how do you...
I don't know that I can see a distinction with a difference between the two. To me, that would be one and the same. I just don't see the factual distinction between the two.
So it's not preserved. Your suggestion is it doesn't matter if it's on habeas or not. It's not preserved. It's not going to be a reversal per se.
Correct. And I think there's absolutely good reason why it wasn't preserved, because trial counsel knew, just like everybody else in the courtroom, that it was the smart thing to do. It's a safe thing to do.
Justice Hardison?
I think you have some additional time, so I'd like to ask you a follow-up question in this area. My understanding of Ms. Thomas's argument on this Presley issue is that it would ipso facto in a direct appeal result in a conclusion of structural error, in effect. Yet, I raise the question about whether it does in the context of a plain error finding. If there's no objection and we assume that this is plain error, is this court limited, or have we established in prior jurisprudence that we will evaluate plain error based upon whether it is harmless as opposed to whether it is structural?
I think that's the dichotomy for the court. I'm not sure that I can read a clear indication from the court's prior decision which way the court has ruled.
Do you think that issue is out there? Assuming we conclude that there was a Presley error, do you think that issue is a viable issue that would need to be addressed in the disposition of this case?
Yes, this and for the future going forward. I would certainly invite the court to address it.
Okay.
There's one thing that it dawned on me, that the issue of the black plastic bag may not be an issue of import, and I apologize not to be so bold to suggest whether it is or isn't to this court, but it's an important issue that I see reoccurring by motion work in the 8th Judicial District Court, and that is, how do you find an expert to testify about rather unique sets of circumstances? In this particular case, there were minute tears in black plastic bag, kind of the typical garden walking bag that you receive for leaves. That color, and almost grayish in color, and they were found in a large or moderately significant number around both bodies. And the interesting thing forensically from detectives arriving at the scene was there were no shell casings, which leads to some obvious conclusions, but not, as you, I'm sure you're all aware of, maybe not conclusive conclusions. Revolver obviously being it. But ultimately, when one of the victim's fathers was moving the television after taking back the property after services for his son, found a shell casing, called the police, came out. Now the detectives had an additional set of circumstances where there was the potential that either the collection of the devices or using something to collect the shell casings was involved. These plastic things had been seen by the testifying very senior crime scene analyst Pete Shelberg, saying that he had seen it on occasions where people have attempted to muffle or to silence a weapon by using a plastic bag and some other items on it, either to silence and or to collect the rounds, which is what he testified in this case. And I would urge the court to also look at that, because I believe that there are certain people who may not be in the traditional roles, in the Lord case, the discussion of whether or not wounds recently and self-defense wounds are only the province of physicians or forensic psychologists. I would suggest that there are a multitude of people who have the appropriate training experience outside of some traditionally recognized expertise, physicians in the course of forensic pathology. But here, crime scene analysts and homicide detectives hold a very unique role in the number of violent death scenes that they observe and the telltale evidence that is derived from them. And I would suggest that in this case and lots of others, they are appropriate notice expert witnesses to testify even under some unusual circumstances such as this black plastic. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stanton. Ms. Thomas.
If the court is approved, so I'll address the issues in the order presented by Mr. Stanton, starting with the testimony of Tammy Bass. If the prosecutor's point here was to say that sometimes the parole board makes mistakes, he could have asked that question. He could have talked about parole board making mistakes. There was zero reason to introduce the concept that a sentence of life without the possibility of parole does not in fact mean life without the possibility of parole, that commutations are possible, and that Mr. Jeremias, even if given a sentence of life without the possibility of parole, could be released to the streets. His entire objective could have been introduced without bringing in that issue. Allowing the jury to hear that testimony was very damaging. I can almost think of nothing more damaging in a capital case.
Your comment for the prosecutor introduced evidence to rebut the claim that he's not going to get out? Now, didn't the defense introduce that concept that, hey, this is really, really rare, probably unlikely to happen? So didn't the defense introduce that?
They talked about that in the context of if a sentence allowing parole is given, it's unlikely that he's going to be out. They never made that claim on a life without. And given the statutory change, which is critical between Geary and this case, that would not be a proper rebuttal. If the jury was misled into thinking that LWOP doesn't mean LWOP, under Simmons versus South Carolina, that was highly improper, and the case should be reversed on that ground alone. On the Rios' statement, the prosecutor states that the statement itself was not admitted as evidence. That is not correct. It was admitted as Exhibit 34 at 13 ROA 2838 and at 25 ROA 5413 to 47. The entire interrogation came in. The statements admitted here were not simply those concerning the facts of the case. They were very much used to paint Mr. Jeremias as a violent person that his own friend feared being shot by. And all of those inherent unreliability issues fully apply here. The prosecutor did not address why that was not noticed in the state's notice of evidence and aggravation. That evidence should have never been allowed in this penalty trial. On the issue of the courtroom closure.
Ma'am, before we leave the other point, why didn't counsel object to the notice?
They should have. I don't know why they didn't. I can think of no strategical or tactical reason for not. That testimony was highly damaging. It should have been excluded. I don't know why they didn't object.
Two in this case. It sounds like the defense attorney had a little bit to do with the parents being, or the family being, exited from the court. It looks like the defense attorney had a little bit to do saying, as I did when I was a defense attorney, well, we'll let the prosecutor lead a little bit so we don't get any of this nonsense in the statement of a co-defendant. How do we justify it?
I would really like to address that issue, and it's complicated because I asked that the record on appeal include portions of the Rios trial, especially the Zapata transcript and the evidentiary rulings. And the state opposed that motion and said, no, that's not properly before this court. And there was a one-judge order saying, no, that's not coming in. Same case number, same judge, same prosecutor, same witness, but it's not part of this record. I beg you, put that in this record and let me do supplemental briefing on that issue. It clearly formed the district court's ruling in this case, the prosecutor's actions. Now we're hearing that defense counsel wanted this to be tailored. There's none of that discussion in this record. There's no discussion about gangs and things happening before and after that they needed to tiptoe around. Those justifications are not in this record. What we have is trial counsel objecting over and over and over again, which looks like they didn't in fact want the testimony to be presented that way. But I don't know how to respond to those issues without having Zapata's testimony from the Rios trial included in this record on appeal.
Well, was that testimony from the Rios trial used by the defense counsel to cross-examine?
It certainly was used by the prosecution. I believe it was referenced. I don't think it was admitted itself. But certainly in a case with co-defendants from the same district court number, the decisions made during the Rios trial had an impact on this trial. For this court to conduct a full and fair appellate review, all of that needs to be in this record. And I would ask to be able to do supplemental briefing on that issue. But everything the prosecutor said about that issue, that the defense counsel wanting to limit the testimony, none of that's a part of this record. The other thing I would note is there seems to be some confusion about the apartments. There are two apartments, the victim's apartment and Mr. Rios's apartment. The prosecutor was discussing here the questions about things that took place at the Rios apartment. The objectionable and highly inflammatory part of this case concerns Mr. Jeremias's alleged description of what took place at the victim's apartment. That's what goes to the premeditation and deliberation. That's the evidence that wasn't put in through anyone else. And that's the critical conversation at issue here. On the closure of the courtroom.
Excuse me.
This idea that logistical concerns and congestion can justify closure of a courtroom is gone. The U.S. Supreme Court resolved that issue in Presley. If that means that they need to call a panel of 60 jurors instead of 75, if they need to move to a bigger courtroom, if they need to make some other accommodation, if they need to instruct the public and the families not to talk to the jurors, all of those accommodations need to be made for a constitutional right. And sometimes constitutional rights are not convenient, but we don't just throw them away because everyone thinks it'll go easier if we do. The judge here did not say, you can come back in very short order, just go hang out in the hallway until someone leaves. The record here also doesn't reflect the fact that this is not like back east where jury selection in the capital case goes on for a month, 6 weeks. Jury selection in this capital case took 2 days. Most of the jurors were not dismissed until the end of that first day. There's a lot that goes on in Nevada jury selection in a single day. And telling people you need to leave because we need every space available in this courtroom is simply not enough. It can't be allowed. The plastic bag issue and creating some law enforcement exception to Hallmark kids and the statutes, that was never briefed. That argument appears nowhere in the state's answering brief. And we can't do it now on oral argument with time over. So I would urge this court to reject that issue and ask that you reverse both the penalty and the judgment in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stanton. Ms. Thomas, thank you for your arguments and briefs in this matter. This matter